like for me, the biggest thing is how you is how your relationships are with everyone that's involved. And that's why I started the label, because, you know, I had great relationships with all the artists. I didn't want it to stop, you know. So yeah. I wanted to be able to, like, I could see that, hey, like, you know, if we kind of get together and stay together as a team and really work on the things that you're not sure about yet and that I can help you with, and that our friends and PR can help with, we can really achieve like all the goals that everybody wants.
We're back for episode 7 of First Pressing. Today, we're joined by Perth producer Sam Ford from Tone City Records.
With all my artists, helping them kind of curate bills that are going to benefit them. And again, it comes back to the whole family vibe. Coming from a creative background and relationship with the artists, and then that intertwining into just one big process, you have this connection where you can talk openly and honestly about everything, whether it be good or bad, and everything's kind of okay because of your relationship. Even after doing records that had quite a lot of radio success and stuff, building up an actual business is something different. And when you're young, you don't really understand how much it takes and the longevity that you need to have.
Sam is a Perth-based musician and producer who has worked with some of the biggest names in WA music. We're talking Abby May, Pond, Psychedelic Prawn Crumpets, and Birds of Tokyo. His passion for supporting and nurturing the next generation of music makers has put WA on both the national and international map, and his work is only just starting. This is Sam Ford from Tone City Records.
Basically, the label started because I was working with a bunch of artists I thought had heaps of potential on a national and international level, just from, you know, working in the studio for such a long time. You kind of like build up a bit of a, I don't know, a little bit of an instinct for when somebody's got something good going on, and they kind of weren't getting the opportunity that they probably could have got or that I wanted them to get
right
from other labels around the country, or they just didn't have the means or the experience to know how to put together their releases and kind of tie everything together to give themselves the best opportunity. So I thought, fuck it, I'm going to start my own label.
And here we are talking about it.
Currently, we've got 5 artists. We've got Super Thick, Dice, I'm going to forget someone, Nectar, it's early, Siobhan Cotchin.
Hey, Mr. Barman, won't you fill my cup? I've been waiting all day for some kind of pick-me-up.
Maddox Plain, that's 6, I think, and Ben Witt.
Yep.
As well, Romeo Walker, so.
Yeah, cool. It's very new, like last year.
Yeah, I think we launched it in January, which was super fun. We did a big launch show down at Freo Social, which was really cool, with a bunch of other really great WA artists, like Banjo Lucia was there, Claudie Joy, heaps, King Blue.
Yeah, cool. Is there like an ethos, really, or is there like a mission statement behind it, or is it
Yeah, I mean, I think like originally when I started it, it was more of me kind of like dipping my toe in a little bit, and you know, I kind of reached out to a bunch of people for support, really, because the current program, I've got it split now, but how it began was as an artist development program that I could run, which was kind of like, I suppose, like a safe way of starting a label, because I mean, given that they're kind of, we say baby artists, because they're not you know, bringing in enough income to like sustain themselves, you know. So rather than me taking on a lot of risk financially, personally. I put it together as a program where I could kind of build them up, and they have complete ownership of all their music and publishing, all their royalties. So it's kind of like a mutual beneficiary, I suppose, like to both parties. So I get to work with bands that I love, and they get to have all the elements that you would have with a major label, but while retaining everything artistically, which is super important. And yeah, so I suppose like halfway through, as I kind of started putting it together, actually didn't get funding at the start. The grant that I was going for went to Guns N' Roses instead.
Didn't they reduce their tickets?
Yeah. But at that point I kind of like had already decided like, okay, I'm going to launch the label. And I was determined to do it like either way. So I ended up, I won't say how much, but I ran in the red out of my my bank account down to below zero for a while to deliver everything that I wanted to deliver with the artist, whether we got the grant or not. So, So it was a bit of a hectic start to the year. And then as things kind of progressed, a lot of the people who I reached out to as partners for the program, and I've got some really great friends who work at Meteor Arts Lawyers over in Sydney. David Vodica, he was actually, he actually signed my band, The Silence, like way back in, I feel old, but probably like 2006 or something.
Right.
And he's a music lawyer and he's kind of helped me out ever since. And he kind of pitched to me that, the program that's going on, there's a big hole, in that space in music in general. And it was a really good, idea, and that I should, go in, fully with it and make it a legitimate label instead of just kind of, floating around the edges and running the program. So he actually helped me organize a distribution partner.
Oh, cool.
I mean, a few years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do it because I wouldn't have been confident enough in what I was doing or in my plan. But having sat in that room for 20 years and recorded and thought about it and stuff, I was at a point that I could talk to those kind of bigwigs and work out which ones kind of felt like a good fit and which didn't. And I ended up speaking to pretty much everyone that did distribution,
right,
and label deals and things like that. And when I spoke to Ingrooves, which is who we've partnered with, they were just like instantly fantastic and knew all the artists and were just kind of all about the music and the data, but
yeah,
not just the data.
Data's an important thing these days.
Yeah, it's interesting. To start any label, you'd need money, and it's really hard to get people to invest in young artists because they don't have the streams or the numbers to back it up. But Ingrooves really kind of believe in the artists and in what I want to put together and the longevity of it. And they came on board as a partner for distribution, but they do so much more as well. So like I've got like a daily label manager, Ruby, who's awesome. And yeah, they put in a lot of work. So having them kind of made me be able to take the step from it being just a program to being like a fully fledged indie label.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I didn't realize all that stuff. And the way I run a label is not like that at all. There's no like professional level to it. There's no lawyers involved. It's just very much like supporting my mates and
yeah.
But still that same ethos of they own everything. I just give them my time.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how it started. And that's definitely still the ethos of the whole label is that everything, even when they're – the good thing about having lawyers involved is that everything is – it kind of puts – well, number one, I have to, because when I'm working with outside partners like Ingrooves, you're dealing with licensing of, the rights of people's songs to distribute. So you have to make sure that it's done right. Otherwise, you can end up doing the wrong thing and not knowing it, or, the artist can get rolled or, so there's lots of reasons to make sure that you do it right. And then also as things progress, like I made my first label, like actual signing a licensing agreement with DICE. And so, because the way that the labels run and my relationship with all the artists, it's pretty chilled. Like we hang out and play Xbox every day, you know, like it's not a super like I'm the label and you're the artist kind of situation. But even in their situation, we still went via lawyers just to make sure that the licensing agreement was good, beneficial for everyone.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's really important to, to have that stuff going on, even for young artists, right? Because it means that they are in control and understand their control and they have to get used to that stuff at some point. Hopefully,
yeah,
you know, as their career grows, they'll do it more and more.
That's it. Yeah. I think the understanding part is the big bit. Like there's still some elements of, you know, publishing and licensing and the wording in the way that people write up agreements that I don't even understand, you know, and I have to get clarification. So, and I've signed them before not knowing what they mean, you know, as an artist, and it's sometimes bit me, you know?
Yeah.
So I thought it was a really important thing to be able to offer them, you know, the chance to actually not just sign something and go through it with a lawyer, but to understand what it all meant. So that's been really exciting. And also just in the space of a year, it's just been interesting, like going into it from like more of a chilled out, cool, like I'm going to run this program. Everyone wants to work together. And, you know, it was a tight knit kind of group who I'd worked with over years with Super Thick, especially and Nectar had been working together for a while. And Romeo Walker. Then, yeah, just seeing kind of how well the team gelled, like not just the between myself and the artist, but also all of the people who are partners with the label, being the distro and also Beehive for PR. And, you know, like you can call them anytime. They're there for everyone, for the artists, for the managers, for myself.
We haven't done this on this podcast actually yet because there haven't been too many conversations maybe about it, but I want to just quickly, like, what's distribution in basic terms for anyone who has no idea?
So don't quote me on this. So basically distribution is how you get your music out to platforms.
And back in the days, it was, you know, a CD, sending CDs to stores and sending vinyl to stores, which still kind of happens a bit.
Still happens a little, yeah.
But now it's just like it's getting it on iTunes or...
Yeah, and so you can have... There's so many different variations of a distribution set up these days. Like you can have... Most people are just doing it themselves, you know? So they'll upload, they'll pay a fee, an annual fee. I think things like Gyrostream are really good. And I think with Gyro, you pay like an upfront fee for the year.
I use it quite a bit. They have both options. Yeah. You can pay yearly or you just pay like one-hour fee.
Yeah. And so basically what you're doing there is paying a licensing fee, similar to what you would if you were signing a licensing agreement, but it's kind of on your terms and they're not, rather than them taking a royalty out of what you make, they just take an upfront payment. Whereas I have a label distribution deal. So basically anything that I put out as a label is distributed by Ingrooves and they have like a percentage that they take, which is standard industry distro fee.
But with that comes them wanting to push it a bit more.
Yeah. And also just like in terms of them committing to back a project like this is it's like a long-term kind of investment in not just myself but the artist as well. So it's something that we work on as a group all the time. You know, like it's been really exciting this year going over and catching up with them in Sydney and, you know, like for me the biggest thing is how your relationships are with everyone that's involved. And that's why I started the label because, you know, I had great relationships with all the artists. I didn't want it to stop, you know? So yeah. I wanted to be able to, like, I could see that, hey, like, you know, if we kind of get together and stay together as a team and really work on the things that you're not sure about yet and that I can help you with and that our friends and PR can help with, we can really achieve like all the goals that everybody wants. And having the distribution as part of that is like a massive thing because they're also global. So, like I think Dice got a few like really good playlists this year that were US based and that wouldn't have happened without them. So it's really good.
And then the other side was publicity or PR, which like if you haven't heard of that, it's just essentially you have someone who sends it out to radio and services it to places like RTRFM and media and stuff.
PR is a massive one, especially these days.
It's very expensive, so being able to offer it is huge.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of money. And I mean, like, it ranges from $1,000 to $6,000, you know, depending on where you're at and how much you can spend and what you're going to get. It's a lot of the time, it's kind of like for me, I've invested a lot with Beehive, because what you learn to realize with PR is that it's quite hard to quantify sometimes.
Yeah.
So if you're a young artist and you're looking at releasing a track and you think, shit, I need to get PR, otherwise no one's going to hear my song. You really need to have, there's so many boxes that you have to tick other than just getting the PR that, you know, you might not see what you think is a return on the money that you invest in the particular campaign that you do. And you also have to be super, diligent in what campaign you choose, depending on what song you're pushing, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I've had a lot of people that I've worked with that are separate to the label that I'm always happy to give advice to people. And to be to be honest, I think next year I'm going to have to start
charging
or just like turning my email off, because I it's really hard when you're working with an artist in the studio to not want to help them kind of succeed. And also if they have questions, it's really hard to not give them your energy or time, because, you know, it's unless they're generally everyone I work with is a great person. So, you know, you want to help them out. But the biggest thing that I probably come across is people just not being aware of what song to pick as a single. And then if they, what their expectation for the track is, if they end up getting PR, a lot of the time it's not aligned with what the direction of the track is, or where the track's going to kind of succeed or find its pocket.
Yep.
So like if you've got like a 10-minute slow jam, probably better off doing something like an editorial campaign with a sick video to get that track out there, because it's not going to fit into a radio box or necessarily be on New Music Friday. So spending, you know, however much money on a playlisting and radio campaign, it's not going to benefit you. So I think sometimes people's perception of PR is like skewed because of those kind of situations where they're not, and it all comes from experience. And it's just, if you're not sure and you make the wrong kind of match up between your campaign and your song, then you're going to have like a different outcome to what you expect.
Yeah. And when I do Blue Grey Pink PR, we do it ourselves. And it's hard. It's like you spend a lot of time emailing the same people you've emailed a lot of times, and sometimes the track, they love it and go with it. Sometimes they don't.
Yeah.
And I'm never, you know, I've never serviced anything that I think is not good. I'm just like, why don't you like this?
Yeah. I've done the same thing. Like when I first started, before I started the label, I started helping with doing press releases and stuff. And I remember chatting to a really good bloke that worked for Pole Rats, Hayden.
Hayden, yeah.
Yeah. And I got a message back and he was like, oh, I've never received a... It was a Nectar track, I think, and he ran a premiere for it. And it was the first press release I'd put together. And I just did it because I thought the band were great and they didn't have money for PR. And I was like, man, I think this is a really good song. Like, why don't we just make something and send it out? And Hayden was kind of like, oh, I'm going to run this premiere, but I've never received a pitch from a recording studio before. And I thought that was kind of like, I'd never sent one before, but it was interesting because me being a producer is so close to, it seems like a natural progression from recording and being a part of that process to then being a part of the release, because you're so close to the music and the artist. So I think that kind of is what really started me thinking about like, oh, maybe I can help people out further than just sending a press release, you know?
Yeah, it is quite a unique setup now that I think about it more. As, you know, the producer, you are very close to the tracks. It makes sense that you would be passionate about it. I don't know, are there any other examples of people who are this close to the track
starting the label? There's a couple. Dan Albach from the Black Keys, his studio label setup is kind of similar in that he kind of went, like, he's always had a few different projects, like, outside of the Black Keys in being his own stuff. Like, he's more kind of straight up bluesy, you know, raw stuff that's not going to be a TV banger, not going to make the millions from an ad sync. He started, I think it's called Easy Eye Sound. And it was just a studio where he got to produce bands that he dug. And then that turned into a label. And right. I think they may have been kind of, they've partnered or bought out with RCA or something like
yeah,
that
right.
in America. But It's a similar setup to that, you know. So basically, like, I mean, I've been recording for 20 years in Perth, and it's a great opportunity for me to kind of settle down a little bit in a way, like, rather than, you know, working with a large volume of artists, I get to kind of focus all of my energy on a smaller group of artists. And I've found that at this point in my career, I'm able to get more from that personally and also give more to the artists with just a smaller pool and giving them everything that I can. And also through everything that I've learned from being a muso and being a part of the industry for that length of time. And it's just a lot more rewarding, I suppose, for me now than doing like one day singles, because I need a bit more connection these days.
Yeah, because I was going to say, if you're trying to record lots of people and also be a label and put these tracks out, that's like a lot of, that's time consuming. It'd be hard to be balanced recording people while also putting stuff out.
Yeah, I would say this year in my life, it's not been balanced at all. Because, I'm building a new studio down in Injedup at the moment, which is awesome. And I did it because I need a fresh change and creatively. And also, I just think it's something that we don't have. And the country doesn't even really have, like, there's a couple of regional location studios, but, not like what we're doing down south. And
this
is why I have no balance. So I've been building, I've been planning to move, and which is super scary, you know, like I've been at my studio for 14 years.
Wow.
And have heaps of awesome memories and have worked with lots of amazing Perth artists in there. And over the course of this year, I've, you know, done a full move down to Injedup. Currently don't have a house, waiting for it all to get finished and launch the label and worked kind of like 6 to 7 days a week for the last 3 years, trying to work with lots of artists and also launch the label. And the work kind of doesn't end at five, because then I have to work on people's PR assets and release schedules and all of that. So
yep, I can relate.
Yeah. So I think that's where this year I kind of got to a point where I'm like, all right, next year I'm going to slow down a bit and schedule my working life like a normal human being to the best of my ability, because I'll also be able to give everybody my full energy, whereas at the moment I'm kind of like a drained battery.
Yeah. It's the first year of running a label.
Yeah.
It's not going to be
easy. Yeah. No, it's super interesting. I mean, like, I've got a bit of a co-management role, with a couple of the artists, with Dice and with Maddock playing as well. It's not your standard setup, I suppose. Like, personally, I don't really love having to deal with people in between me and the band, because I'm used to being the producer where it's just me and the band. And you have this connection where you can talk openly and honestly about everything, whether it be good or bad, and everything's kind of okay because of your relationship on a creative side. And then when it comes to the label side, often and I've been in the same situation when I've had management as an artist, the label side, because there's, you know, money involved and all that other stuff, you know, it just kind of becomes a little bit like the label versus the band, and that's kind of not how I roll. So for me, it's really important to have like a super open communication between myself and the artist. And I found myself doing a lot of things that a manager would do. So I don't just release the tracks. Like, I'm talking to the bands every day, every band every day. So it's much more of a co-management role. And I don't really see it as like a separate. I kind of feel like the future of labels it's the standard kind of setup of what a major label system has been. I don't know how much life it has left in it in terms of like how bands interact with the label. Your relationship with the label is like, you know, ends up being the biggest thing. That's why people end up needing lawyers, you know, and coming from a creative background and relationship with the artists, and then that intertwining into just one big process from kind of, the seed of the track to it being released, just feels like a really good open workflow. And we haven't, yeah, it's been really, that side of things has been really easy.
Let's dive into you a bit more, how you got started in music, or even let's go fucking real far back.
When was I born?
What was your first music memory?
My first music memory was my cousin getting a Ibanez Strat copy for Christmas. I was like a drummer at that point because I wasn't a drummer, but I'd learnt drums at school on a pad, and I saw the guitar and I was like, man, I want to play a Strat, even though it wasn't a Strat. And from that point on, I just wanted to play music.
Right.
It's a weird memory, but...
That's good. Why were you playing drums?
I wasn't really like a winner at school. Like, I went to a private all-boys school and fucking hated it and ended up like, I don't know. I don't even know why I was there, just to not be anywhere else. I was just hitting a rubber pad in the music room. I kind of always enjoyed music, but I don't think I ever thought about it as like a career or anything like that until my later years of school. And some of the guys from The Silence, my first band, were actually at school with me. So
yeah,
that's kind of how I met those guys.
Right. And so you played in The Silence. That was kind of where you went after school.
Yeah, pretty much straight away. I actually met Jamie, and he's now playing with Pond, which is awesome. And yeah, I met them at school. And then straight after that, that's all we did. That's all I did for like 10 years after I left school. Got fired from numerous jobs for forgetting to open the store or going and rehearsing instead. Yeah, we entered heaps of shitty band comps and lost. And it was a really good time though. I kind of miss those days of just rehearsing at ludicrous volumes in a parent's garage and having ringing in your ears for the next 2 days. But now I'm very careful with my ears and...
Yeah.
Had my plugs in.
You had some success with The Silence, right? Like,
yeah, it was kind of really fun, and also I wish I took more of it in at the time. Because we would have only been 19, I think, when we signed our first deal,
right,
which was to David Vodica's label, Rubber Records. And Andy Lawson, who's another producer in town, he was actually on the same label in his band, The Avenues. So
right,
there was a few people that I knew around. And then, so I would have been pretty young. And we kind of started touring not long after that. We did a national tour. I remember a regional tour. And then we made an EP with Parco at Blackbird, and I love Parco. Ever since then, we've been really good friends, and he was a great, great guy and influence on us. And so we made our first EP there, and that ended up getting a little bit of, or a lot of, Triple J play. And then I actually got a phone call from one of the guys from the Vines, Ryan, who was their guitar player. This is how music has changed. He heard our track on the radio and called us up and said, hey, I dig this song. And they were like our favorite band at the time. Do you want to come on tour? And I was like, yeah, yes, please, you know?
Yeah.
Before I was 23, we were, touring around the country with them and with the Vines and the Living End. We did national tours with and Tame, and played with a whole bunch of people who were like musical heroes at the time. And I'm still friends with most of them now. So it's nice to look back on, but it kind of comes really easy when you're the artist and you're young, because you haven't had time to think that it won't work out.
Yeah.
And so, I think for me personally, I kind of like just always felt like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. And it just kind of all fell into place up to a point, and then it all fell apart.
Right.
And then I ended up working out, I ended up jumping in the studio with Abby May as my band was kind of, as The Silence left our label. Second, we signed a deal with Ivy League Records, and they're an awesome label. And Andy Castle was our guy there, who was an awesome guy as well. Anyway, we went off as bands do in a crazy tangent to do the opposite of what we had done the first time.
Right.
And that didn't really work out for a commercial success. And so we made a choice to make a record that we wanted and not one that was necessarily going to be commercially successful. And then I kind of moved, like at the same time, I moved into playing and working with Abby in the studio. And kind of from that point on, I was more studio focused, I suppose.
Yeah.
I was with Abby for about 5 years, I think. We did 2 records together, Design Desire and Kiss My Apocalypse with the 2 records.
Huge albums.
Yeah, it was really like an exciting time. And also because I was in the band, like I got to do heaps of touring, and my life has kind of always been just like nonstop music in some way, whether it's in the studio or being on the road. Although these days I've kind of hung up the touring boots.
Yeah.
No more 4 a.m. flights for me.
What was your first recording thing that you kind of did?
The first recording, I mean, the first, like, I recorded Silence demos and friends, Sex Panther back in the day, all of their stuff and right. demos and lots of bands that we grew up with. But my first kind of, like, what I would say my first recording was Corridors of Blister Day by Pond. That was the first, like, proper release, even though I'm pretty sure they put it out unmastered. I don't know. It was like, that was still like our... my first kind of proper recording release. Right. And then I did Frond, which was another studio record with Pond. And then I did a third record with Pond. I did Beardwife's Denim, which we recorded down in Eagle Bay in a little shack. And then, yeah, from then on, it was Abby and then hundreds of other great people.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Wow, what a start.
Yeah, it was, I think like if it, because my production was kind of born out of friendships from with great musicians, it was a really good start, because not only did I have kind of the opportunity to work in a studio because I was friends with Dave, and so I would, when we recorded Frond, we would go in after Dave had finished work, so we'd start at 10 p.m and finish at like 9 a.m in the morning every night. At that time, like, you could handle it and it was fun. But now I try to keep it to like, you know, 10 o'clock, you know that's it.
Is your studio called Tone City?
Yeah, so Tone City Recording Studio. It was actually funny. I couldn't work out what to call a studio, and I made a – it wasn't really a bet because it was no award for anyone that won, but Nick from Pond, it was more of a dare. They had a song called Cloud City, which was on Frond, I think. And I said, oh, I should call the studio Tone City. And I was like, fuck it, all right, I'm going to. So yeah, that's how the name came about. I was like, all right, Tone City it is. Yeah, and then I kind of rebuilt the studio twice in my house. And at first it was like a fucking disaster, man, like going from Blackbird, which is, you know, like the most kind of lauded studio in Perth probably, arguably, for a long time. And Dave, who's awesome. So I just remember him having a conversation with him where he was like, you know, just build your, you can do it, you know, go build one. And, because I needed more time and he needed time at the studio, and, you know, he's like, oh, just go and build it and it'll all work out. And I built it and I was like, fuck, I've got no work. For like years, it was a bit of a struggle, but right. you just, that's the thing about the music industry, is you just have to, like, you know, grit it and get through it.
Yeah.
And it took a while. Like it took years before I was like sustainably. It's all I've ever done as a job, bar the couple of cafe jobs I had that I got bounced from. But it was like, it definitely took me a few years, even after doing records that had quite a lot of radio success and stuff. Building up an actual business is something different. And when you're young, you don't really understand how much it takes and the longevity that you need to have in order for it to be kind of sustainable.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, of course. What was it like working with... You worked with Birds of Tokyo?
Yeah. So how did that come about? Ian Burney, who used to play in Sugar Army, hit me up one day, and I actually hadn't met the other guys before, but they were doing some vocal recording in Perth, and I've done quite a lot of like high-end vocal stuff. Like, I don't know, you always get like, it's kind of weird, but you end up specializing in certain things when you end from an engineering point of view. And, you know, like I randomly did Samantha Jade's record, all the vocals for her album, because she was in Perth, unfortunately, because her mum was sick. But she's a beautiful person and came into my little home studio at the time with like her crazy, like, American producer. So anyway, I'd done a bunch of kind of vocal only production, and yeah, Ian hit me up and said, hey, I've got Birds wanting to do an album or a few tracks, and I'd love to get, you know, you to do the job with Kenny. And then when I met Kenny, I just hit it off with him, and he's a legend, such a nice, like one of the best guys I've met. And he actually lives down in Dunsborough now, so he's really close to my new pad, which is great. We'll go for a surf together. But yeah, it's been awesome working with them. I've worked with them on a bunch of singles now, mostly doing vocal production. Like, it kind of changes for all artists. Like, some of the bigger artists I work with, if I'm engineering or doing little bits of production, it might just be vocals, and then you've got someone like Scott Hawcroft on the Zoom to the left of you producing from Sydney, so which is interesting. Sometimes I have to pretend the computer stopped working because it's hard to focus with, like, you know, a laptop on your left and the artist on your right and all your gear in front of you. So
that's such a weird scenario, isn't
it? I mean, like, you can live stream. Yeah, I don't know if anyone listening to the podcast would know necessarily what a mix bus is, but when you're recording, everything's coming out of two channels basically, and that's the mix bus. These days, maybe largely because of COVID, but also because everyone's collaborating so much, like globally, you can actually get like a plugin that will allow someone to stream your mix bus live in high def in their studio.
Right.
So when I was doing some Birds of Tokyo tracks, we would have half the band in Byron Bay on Zoom who were live streaming my mix bus and listening to our vocal takes as we were going, so that they could, you know, have some creative input into it, which is cool and sometimes distracting.
Yeah. I'm trying to imagine, like, and I don't do really recording at all, and that's just like, I figured out quickly my skills were like email and spreadsheets and not being able to put songs together.
Yeah, see, I'm trying to learn spreadsheets, man, quickly.
And I just can't imagine being on a Zoom channel just listening to vocal takes. That sounds so boring to me.
Oh, man. Lots of people do mix. Like, if you're getting a mix done by some kind of big shot over in the States, you know, they offer you, like, for some kind of ludicrous extra amount of money, the ability to live stream the mix. So, like, you hear the tweaks or whatever as you're doing it. But I can't, even from a production point of view, I can't imagine, like, how that would be beneficial to me, because, like, depending on what room you're in or what headphones are on, or it's going to sound different. So it's really like you've got no reference other than just like a general idea of what's going on.
Yeah.
But specifics, it's interesting anyway.
Yeah. So you've worked your ass off, built this studio for many, many years, and your rep as an engineer. And then this year you decided, after a long time, you moved into focusing on a few acts.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm still like 100% open to working with new artists as well. It just has to be, I suppose, like, I'm not a very good no person. And it's not no because the artist is not good enough. It's more no because I know it's not the right fit, or it's not the right time, or they're not quite ready for me to be able to give them what they're expecting from coming to me. So I think moving forward, I'm going to be doing less, but it's going to be more beneficial to everyone, you know, rather than just saying yes to everything, which I think a lot of people do, not just in my industry, but when you run your own business, you get used to feeling like it could be taken away from you at any time. So you just work and work and work. And I think that I finally got to a point this year, basically when I bought my block down south, I was like, okay, man, you got to work your ass off, like, for the next 3 years and get to a point where you feel comfortable, whether it was an outside perception or just like an internal thing, feeling comfortable within myself that I can move down there and go, you know what, I'm going to run this how I think I should run it, and it's going to be okay, which is a big deal, you know, to leave like your nest of 14 years. And it took a lot of hard work to get to where I was there. So to pack up and move felt like, you know, I had many nights where I was like, oh God, what am I doing? But you know, it's like going to be amazing, and you've got to take risks to move forward, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, you've had a lot of wins, right? Like the Wham Awards, you were nominated first year of a label.
Yep.
You didn't win it. No. I did.
You did.
Rubbing it in a little. Yeah. But Siobhan Cochin, who you worked with.
Yeah, she's done fantastically.
Took out like three or four awards.
Yeah.
Super Thick took out a couple.
Yeah, they did really well.
Anyone else on the roster that?
I'm not sure. I tend not to be too concerned with awards these days because I feel like, you know, like in my mind, I had this like chillingly stole from me my opportunity to have my spiel. I was like, in my brain, I'm like, I was going to get up there and be like, don't worry about awards. You're all winners. Yeah. You know, it's like, I've spent like 20 years recording in Perth, and I think even when Abby had like a ARIA nominated record and I co-wrote it and produced it, but I didn't get a nomination in Wham. And I was like, I think that for me was like the moment that I realized that awards don't, they're great to have, but they don't define whether you're successful or not.
No.
So I think, it's great to have the wins that we had this year and like, super appreciate Wham, but I think there's like a lot of work that we can do as a community in Perth and how we run the whole kind of system that could benefit the artists a lot more.
Well, how the hell do you judge art? Like, it's so subjective. It's hard. Like, one of the craziest things in the world to me is like trying to award something creative that, you know, one judge is going to like this better than that.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I always look at it like Leo never won his
Oscar.
His Oscar until he was like 50 or whatever. He's probably not 50. He looks like he's 28 still. Yeah. But, you know, I think for me personally, it was like something that like actually did for a while there. Like it did affect me. I was like, man, like what do I have to do to like, cause you think that if you haven't been in the industry for long enough, things like awards, they seem like these big things that define your career.
Yeah.
And it's not until that you see organic growth and you see your career actually living itself out without awards that you realize that those things kind of are just like a nice thing that might happen.
Yeah. At one point, I reckon I'll do a whole podcast on how I think awards are stupid.
Yeah.
Amazing. So you're taking Tone City out of the city.
And I'm not changing the name.
Good. Well, Tone City goes wherever you go.
That's it.
What a crazy time to launch a label.
Yeah, man.
It's weird.
It's just like everything is weird. Like I got married 3 years ago and the next day it was lockdown.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then I just had my honeymoon and my wife actually got COVID like after 4 days. Oh. And I was like, you've got to be fucking joking. Like I waited 3 years. And yeah, so that's just life, hey. Like you just have to like deal with it. And when I bought my block for Down South, it was just pre-COVID and it was a full bush block still. It was the last residential bush block in that kind of space between Yelling Up and Gracedown. Yeah, when COVID came, heaps of people bailed. Like we worked with an architect who my wife now works for. They're called Whispering Smith and they do like eco-positive builds, okay. Thermo-positive. So it was really interesting doing that because it you know, it's like this slight angle that you put the house on means that at 10 a.m. you're not going to get caned by light and need the right. aircon on kind of thing. And then in conjunction with that, I worked with a acoustics expert from the States for the studio. It's going to be like a really amazing space. Like the studio is kind of like a Mayan temple is the vibe, you know, but it's on the inside. It's like beautifully architecturally designed and feels like a really, it's going to feel like an amazing place to be. Doing it all in 2020.
Yeah.
Was a nightmare. Like heaps of people bailed on their builds, like, put everything on hold and prices went up. And I don't know, it's probably a flaw of mine, but I don't really think too much about things outside of what I want to do. So I just kept going and I'm glad I did because otherwise I'd, you know, be starting a 3-year process now. So, yeah. I mean, there has been like some hardship along the way, that's for sure. But
yeah, building a house is not going to be easy.
Nah. And it's kind of like building two businesses as well. So we have our house and then we'll have accommodation for the artists.
Right.
And there's also accommodation that we'll rent out privately and the studio as well. So it's kind of like been a monster of a build.
Yeah, that sounds hectic.
Yeah. Lots of different parties involved in each kind of
each thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. That's really exciting.
Yeah. I think like I've always kind of wanted to bring a studio that is of the quality of what you would get at Sunset Sound or wherever you are in this, in America, you know, like the best studios are still there, like, and in the UK and a lot of them are in. That's why when I moved my house, I was like, it took me a while to work it out, but I think because we're in Perth and there's so much space compared to places like New York and things like that, you know, people have their own expectation of what a studio is. And one of the great examples of like a urban studio is Daptone, which is like Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and Daptone Records, which is another example of a great small record label that has that kind of like the artists are part of the label.
Yeah.
And they run out of Brooklyn, but their studio was literally in a block of flats. And they had like car tires on the floors filled with sand and then timber on top of them. And that's where they did like Amy Winehouse, just an amazing studio and so many hits made there.
Yeah.
But it's just in a little rundown house in Brooklyn. And I think in Australia, we've got so much space that their expectation is that, you know, space is the place, but it is in mixes and in songs, but sometimes not in studios. And so my goal has always been to bring like a high-end world-class studio to Perth or to Australia. And, you know, I managed to like somehow half get there with the one in my old bedroom in Scarborough for 14 years. So like now I actually get to do it for real. And, you know, like for me, it's more about the passion side of it. Like I've overcapitalized in a ludicrous way building the studio that I'm building down south, but I feel like it's something that's going to be really special and available to artists in Perth that are around now and also for the next, you know, however long I can kick on.
Yeah.
And it'll just be an opportunity that's not been there and one that hopefully will have lots of great records made.
Yeah, for sure. I want to come down and stay there and welcome. Make an album.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. It's, I mean, like I've kind of teed up a few things. Like there's a few like great kind of like, paddock to plate chefs down there.
Yeah. Right.
Organic, vegan places that we can have people come around and depending on the band's budget and what they want, they can come into the main house. And we've kind of built our house based around this big ass, like, French commercial kitchen like bench,
right,
so that people can come in and we can have like wine tastings from Vass, which is around the corner, and have food cooked. It's going to be kind of whatever you want it to be.
Wow.
Which is awesome.
That's so impressive.
Yeah, I can't wait, man. I'm kind of like, at the moment I don't have a house and I'm in limbo. Yeah. So I've like been in like packing up house mode and then putting together a mobile recording rig. And yeah, so apologies if I'm all over the place in this interview.
No, thank you for coming in. Let's quickly talk about the event side of things, because you are running a lot of Tone City events.
Yeah, so that's like another thing that I committed to and then overcommitted to, and now it's part of what I do. it's kind of like all aspects of it, you know, like you see, it kind of comes from going, you know what, like I think these people deserve this, and if it's not happening, you do it and then you just end up keep doing it. So, you know, I growing up being a part of Spinning Top and having Jody as my manager for a long time with The Silence and just being a part of that crew, you kind of like, I don't know, when you see other people have success in a group family orientated kind of team, it opens your eyes to what's possible, I suppose. You don't necessarily, you know, need somebody else to do it for you. So I started, yeah, putting on this annual Christmas party, because it actually used to be a Spinning Top. We would always have a party at the end of each year, yeah, and then right. They kind of LA'd it up, and now I'm kind of like the old rock dog left in Perth. So I was like, fuck it, I'll put on a Christmas party. And it's just been super fun. And like lots of years I've tried to bring some artists back. Like last year we had Sugar Army play, which was super fun. And I'd love to get The Silence on there one day, but I don't know if it's going to happen. And then just like with all my artists, helping them kind of curate bills that are going to benefit them. And again, it comes back to the whole family vibe of the label, which is that everyone kind of genuinely does appreciate each other's music and wants to see success for all the other artists on the label. So joining together, basically I give everybody the opportunity that for their launches, I'll do all the promotion and book. And obviously it's up to them who they want to play, but I will help curate the lineup if they need help, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's kind of like evolve from there, which is kind of scary because you have to pay, you know, lots of money up front. And for me, I'm not really versed in event management. I'm just doing it and hoping that it works out well.
It's amazing how much of this music industry is just doing it.
Yeah,
That hard.
Yeah, you just kind of, hey, do you want to play this gig?
Yeah. It's really easy to figure it out. It's just maybe very risky.
Yeah, so the risk factor is high. But, you know, I think the event side of things is something that I really want to grow. I'm hoping to kind of, basically next year, Tone City is going to look a lot different. It'll kind of look a bit more like a more structured kind of business tree, if you know what I mean. So we'll have kind of an events section. We have a management section. The label will be there, the artist development program, and also the studio.
Yeah, cool.
And at the moment, it's just me. So if anybody out there is listening that wants to help out, email me. Come on, Mark.
Yeah, I got my own label to run. Thank you so much.
No stress, man. Thanks for having me.
A big thank you to Sam Ford for joining us on First Pressing. My name is Mark Neal, and I'm your host. Our producer is Danielle Raphael, with production consultation by Matthew Perrott. Our artwork is by Lyndon Blue. Music is by Michael Strong. This podcast was recorded and produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. We pay our respects to elders past and present. This land was never ceded. Surprise! You may not have thought it, but we're going to be back with a bonus episode dropping for you next fortnight. It's none other than me talking about my label, Blue Grey Pink, with the wonderful Matthew Perrott. That's next time on our bonus episode of First Pressing.